It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, even though plans to reopen state and local economies are getting released, a vaccine to combat the novel coronavirus is likely to be a long way off. We'll talk to a doctor and vaccine expert on what needs to happen before we can put the pandemic behind us. First, writing a letter definitely takes more time than maybe sending a text, but sometimes that time and hands-on effort might be just what we need. Maybe we could all use a little snail mail right now, and April just happens to be letter-writing month. By the way, the World Health Organization has said that the likelihood of an infected person contaminating commercial goods is low, and the risk of catching the virus that causes COVID-19 from a package that's been moved, traveled, and exposed to different conditions and temperature is also low. If you're still worried, they suggest practicing good hand washing after you handle the mail. We have two avid snail mail senders with us right now. Jenny Hinchcliffe co-wrote the book Good Mail Day about creating and sending artful mail. She's founder of the San Francisco Correspondents Co-op and exhibitions manager at the San Francisco Center for the Book. Jenny, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hi there, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
And Donovan Beeson co-founded the Letter Writers Alliance, an organization dedicated to keeping the practice of letter writing alive. She's also an artist and illustrator. Donovan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to meet you.
Well, I want to ask both of you, how about Donovan first? When did you get so into sending letters and mail?
I've always really enjoyed the mail. I think the genesis of my love started with I had a grandmother who lived far away from me. I grew up in South Carolina, and she lived in Colorado. And she would send me little packages, and we called them goodie boxes. And it was nothing special. It was a lot of, like, free samples and just the things for me to enjoy opening. It was that, and it was also the once upon a time, the Publisher's Clearinghouse used to mail out large packets, and it was just junk, but they would have these stamps inside of them where you were supposed to, like, undo these postage stamp-like objects, and they were all for, like, magazines or something, and I just found that fascinating. So a lot of that.
Jenny, where did your love for the mail come from?
Well, like Donovan, also as a small child, I remember in the fifth grade when I was in grade school, I checked out a book from my grade school library. It was called SWAK, S-W-A-K, the Postal Art Book of Fun for Kids. And there were all sorts of great kind of cool things you could do in the mail, like mailing away for autographs or getting signed posters of your favorite, you know, sports hero. But I remember in the back of that book, there was a little section about these people who would send weird things through the mail, crazy things like coconuts and, you know, baseball bats. And I thought, wow, like that kind of blew my mind as a, you know, like fifth grader. So I started sort of digging into that and writing more letters to my friends and my family from there. So,
Donovan, you co-founded a whole organization dedicated to getting people to send more mail. And from the people you're in touch with now, do you get a sense that people are more excited about taking the time to, you know, write a letter or do something artistic, send it in the mail, you know, open that correspondence where maybe they'd let it fizzle over the years?
I'm not sure if it's a more excited, but it's definitely something that I find people who are familiar with letter writing enjoy remembering that they enjoyed it. And there's also a whole group of people, mostly younger people, that just have no conception of it. They had no idea that you could send things through the mail the way that we do. For such a small amount of money, you can really, really impact someone's life.
And Jenny, I know you work a lot on sending artistic creations through the mail. Is there a way that somebody could get involved with it that you would suggest for the, let's say, the people like me who are less artistically inclined?
Absolutely. It's actually quite easy to get involved. A lot of times people have materials around their house, you know, that they don't even realize could be sent through the mail. So, for example, you can cut up the image on the cereal box and, you know, write on the back of the cardboard piece and put a stamp on that and send that through the mail. As long as you adhere to postal guidelines, you can get pretty much anything through the mail. So, you know, postcards have to be 4 by 6 inches. Envelopes need to be a standard size. The postage stamp needs to be in the upper right-hand corner. Your return address has to be on the upper left. But other than that, you can send a lot of pretty cool, pretty interesting things. So I always encourage people to look differently at the materials they have on hand, you know. So even if that's like a handful of colored pencils or a pencil and pen and, you know, like photographs that you had printed at the photo mat, you know, 2 weeks ago, if people still do that. You know, anything could be turned into a piece of mail to send through the post.
We're talking about the joys of sending and receiving mail. We have Jenny Hinchcliffe with us, author of the book A Good Mail Day, about creating and sending artful mail, and Donovan Beeson with the Letter Writers Alliance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you like to write letters? Have you gotten into it, or maybe even more into it, during this time of safer at home here in the state and around the country? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've heard from some of you on Facebook already. Elizabeth says she's doing a campaign sending 8 happy notes a day to tell people that she misses them during isolation. She says she's a social person. Donovan, how about that, the feeling of connection we get when we send a letter, and maybe even more so when we receive a letter?
Well, I always tell people that letters are really what they are. They're a gift of your time, and you're giving that time to someone, and you can't, when we give gifts, we can't expect to receive them in the mail, but I think that those people that are more giving also see things return to them more. So if it's something that you enjoy spreading joy through the mail, you're going to get that in return. That's how it works.
And Jenny, going back to the idea of sending art in the mail, there's a movement, and you're part of this movement of sending art in the mail. How awesome is it to get that thing from someone you know that is a, you know, a small act of creation?
Oh, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, I agree 100% with Donovan that, you know, making something to send to someone else through the mail is truly a gift of time. And so, you know, when you use artistic expression, one's own personal artistic expression to, you know, create a handmade postcard or take the time to, you know, beautifully handwrite or put into calligraphy a letter of some kind, it is an expression, and it's amazing to both send and receive those expressions.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Angela is with us in Rome. Angela, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that my father was a rural mail carrier. He was very invested in making sure that everybody used the mail. And when I moved away from northern Wisconsin down to Highland Park, Illinois area, I received in the mail one December a Christmas tree. It was about six feet tall, and it was wrapped in brown paper, and it had a lot of stamps on it. And my mailman in Highland Park was just absolutely amazed that that was possible. That was the best thing I ever got in the mail, because I was lonely then.
Wow. Okay, Jenny, you were right. We can mail just about anything, it sounds like, even
it's
a
incredible.
6-foot tree.
My turn of phrase is always what they ask you at the postal counter. It's not liquid, fragile, or potentially hazardous. It does not contain perfume or lithium batteries. You can send it through the mail.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Angela, so much for sharing that story. Donovan, it doesn't have to be something as big as a Christmas tree. Like my wife, for example, has a friend who every week or two, you know, she lives in town, but she'll send a postcard from, you know, however many blocks away. It is pretty cool to see that pop up in the mail. It doesn't have to be a big production, does it?
It doesn't. And even people that are right next door to you, there's something about that extra step that you take to send something through the mail to them that makes it even more special.
We are talking about the joys of snail mail in general, and especially now in this time of isolation and shutdowns around the country. We have Jenny Hinchcliffe with us, co-author of the book Good Mail Day, also the founder of the San Francisco Correspondents Co-op. And Donovan Beeson is with us, co-founder of the Letter Writers Alliance. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy sending mail to other people? Have you ever had a pen pal? Do you create mail art of some sort? Are you getting into mail, back into sending mail, or maybe getting into it for the first time now with Safer at Home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about writing letters and creating art and sending it all in the mail. Donovan Beeson is with us, co-founder of the Letter Writers Alliance, also an artist and illustrator. And Jenny Hinchcliffe co-wrote the book Good Mail Day. She's founder of the San Francisco Correspondents Co-op. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a letter writer from way back? Do you send cool artsy stuff sometimes? Are you getting into it now for the first time in a long time, or the first time ever, as we're staying at home a whole lot more and seeing people a whole lot less? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Polly is with us in Milwaukee. Polly, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
This program was just made for me. In the past 7 weeks, I have a friend in a rehab facility in Kenosha, and we have been sending physical letters back and forth for the last 7 weeks. The day we get the letter, we get the answer back, not even an answer, but what's going on in our lives, get it off the very day we get the mail. So every fourth day or so, we each have a letter in our real mailbox. And as far as getting into creative sending, I also she had a birthday last week, and I cut apart a favorite card I had gotten from someone 3 years ago and redid the card because it was such wonderful images on it, and just pasted a design colorful thing over where her note had been written and wrote my own note on it.
Polly, so. I love it. Thank you so much. It's the cut-up method, Jenny. It can be that simple, just making a little collage from old cards.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, recycling and upcycling materials is always a great idea, for sure.
And Donovan, the idea of this being, kind of a lifeline, this connection with somebody, in this case, in a rehab center, those might be good correspondents in our lives to try to figure out who we can write letters to.
Absolutely. When you cannot visit in person, a letter is a great way to have something tangible, really, to hold on to. Like, we've got telephones, we've got video calling, but we're really touch-hungry people. And having something to actually hold is really important.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Christina now in Glenwood. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm 62 years old, and I've always loved sending and receiving mail, and I have boxes of cards that I send all the time. And I think it stems from when I was 5 years old. I received a card from my great-grandmother. It made me feel so special, and I still have that card to this day. I consider it a treasure. And recently, I sent a card to my two-year-old niece, and it's a brightly colored card with all kinds of animals. So I drew the silhouette of all of these animals. I glued it to the back, and then I took a variety of colored pencils, and I wrote the names on all of them, and I suggested that she go through the card and find all the animals and see if she could name them. And I think that this just shows one of the creative ways that we can make someone feel special in a simple way.
I love that story so much, Christina. Thank you for sharing that. Jenny, do you have things like that are, treasures from some point in your life that you've received in the mail?
Oh, absolutely. I have an archive of, letters and postcards that, I will keep always because they're so meaningful, they're so thoughtful, and, because people have taken the time to write something to me, I always make sure to send something back to them. But Yeah, absolutely. There are things that, you know, they become important, precious mementos and objects. So.
And I love Donovan, you and Jenny and our caller all had, you're like superheroes. You had origin stories about why you became letter writers. Do you hear that a lot from people you've worked with on the Letter Writers Alliance? There's that one letter that got them started.
I don't know that there's one letter, but there definitely becomes, everyone ends up with a mail story for sure. Whether it's something you've sent or something you've received, there's definitely a shining moment in the mailbox for everyone.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Doris now in De Pere. Doris, hi. Do we have you there, Doris?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay, what did you want to tell us about?
I'm in assisted living, and it's nothing much to do. We've been playing bingo in the hall in our apartments, so we're far apart, about once a week. So now the thing is that, what do I send for a letter? I've been clipping out an article from the newspaper and print it on my printer, and then I can just write a few notes so that they know I'm okay. Yeah, my family's all right. So that's my suggestion. Now, the one that I'm writing, sending now, is about the bubbler.
Doris, we're not hearing you too well, but I got the gist there. So in her assisted living facility there, she's using kind of internal mail. It doesn't even have to go through the post office, and that's a way to keep contact even within the facility. Doris, thank you so much for sharing that story. Best to you and all your pen pals there. Let's go now to Carol on the line in Madison. Carol, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for this topic. I'm super excited. I've been writing my whole life. I also had the Free Stuff for Kids book when I was young back in the 80s and learned how to write for things. But one thing I wanted to share, because I had to pick one thing to talk about, is how much fun it is to start with the envelope. So you get an envelope that you're going to send off. I like to make a little block where I'm going to write my address. And then I decorate the envelope thinking about that person. And it's just really fun. You fill the entire, every single corner, and then you have your envelope, and then you write your letter. And it's just a really fun way to write a letter to somebody.
I love it, Carol. Thank you so much. Jenny, do you have thoughts on envelope decoration?
I do. I love envelope decoration. And what's interesting, Carol, is that usually I work the exact opposite. I'll create the item that's going to go inside the envelope, and then I decorate the envelope to match. But, you know, tomato, tomato. So everyone works their own way. So I love hearing about your method of working.
And Donovan, do you pay attention to the wrapping, too, and do some good envelope decorating yourself?
I absolutely do. And it really bounces back and forth for me. I have a P.O. box, and I haven't been able to get there. So I actually ran out of letters to return. So while I wait for my letters to come in, I work on my envelopes.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for that call. We were talking about the joys of writing and receiving letters with Donovan Beeson and Jenny Hinchcliffe. Back to your calls. Peter is on the line in Racine. Peter, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about, Peter?
I used to help my great uncle deliver mail in our little town in Germany, and I collected postage stamps, and we also wrote to Dr. Schweitzer in Africa. And then when I got into the Navy, after I came here, when I got into the Navy, the chief says to me, he says, do you understand all these different things that are coming in the mail here? I said, I certainly do, chief. He says, okay. He says, you're the company mailman now. So every duty station that I went to afterwards, in my papers, in my documents, it was classified that he was company mailman in the previous duty station. So in my fighter squadron on the West Coast, I became company mailman in one squadron after another, and it was truly enjoyable collecting stamps, sending letters, receiving letters, especially my first letters that I received after I came here.
I love it, Peter. Thanks so much. It became your military specialty. I want to bring on one more caller before we run out of time. How about Kitty in Glendale? Kitty, hi.
Hi there. And My story is I graduated from Holy Angels in Milwaukee 55 years ago, and when the pandemic started, Divine Savior Holy Angels, which it is now, asked if we would like to be pen pals. And so they hooked us up with some seniors, and we've been receiving letters and sending letters and getting to know some younger people. And I thought it was such a nice gesture of the school to offer that to us.
Oh, high schools and then seniors getting together. Kitty, thank you for sharing that story. That'd be a good way, Donovan, to reach out right about now, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. That is, I've heard a number of stories about people reconnecting through the mail and also using their postal workers as connections as well. I've seen postal workers offering to pick up people's groceries and run errands, and I think it's all about these connections that we can make and keep.
Time for one more quick call. I think this person knows you. Gina is with us in San Francisco. Gina, hi.
Hi to both Jenny and Donovan, who I have learned a reinvigorating love for mail. When I was little, I moved away a lot from friends and my grandmother, so the letters and postcards and fun stuff in the mail certainly started then. My parents got divorced. I started writing letters with my dad and then reinvigorated that again for the last 6 years of my dad's life when we started writing letters again in 2012. And he actually got into playing with some mail art also.
Fantastic. Gina, we're all out of time. Thank you for calling. Jenny, in our just last 30 seconds or so, can you leave us with a pep talk to maybe mail a letter or some art like Gina was talking about?
Absolutely. I think that sending a letter or a postcard or even a simple note to someone is one of the most encouraging things that you can do. And now more than ever, it's really important to connect and communicate with the people that we love.
Well, we'll leave it there. Jenny, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
And Donovan, thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
We've been talking about the joys of giving and receiving mail. Jenny Hinchcliffe is co-author of the book Good Mail Day and founder of the San Francisco Correspondents Co-op. And Donovan Beeson co-founded the organization Letter Writers Alliance. You can keep sharing your mail stories, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, meat processing plants around the Midwest have become hotspots of the novel coronavirus. We'll talk to a workers' safety expert about the outbreaks and what might have been done to prevent them. First, state and federal leaders are talking a lot about getting back to normal and starting up portions of the economy. But public health officials are warning that without a known vaccine for COVID-19 and adequate testing, the novel coronavirus could be with us for quite a while. How and when the pandemic will end depends on a lot of factors. Dr. Jonathan Tepti is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also chair of the Wisconsin Council on Immunization Practices. Dr. Tepti, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Great to be with you again.
Well, there are a lot of different possible futures here for this disease. Let's start by talking about the prospects for a vaccine. From what we know about this virus, how vaccinable is it in the world of viruses, some of which we have great vaccines for, some of which, like HIV, we've been working for 20 years on?
Well, I think that is the million-dollar question right now. There are, as of today, I think about 115 candidate vaccines, and 78 of those are in active development. You have to go down, though, that only about 5 of those have actually entered any human testing at this point in time. So the long and short is that we are hopeful there will be a vaccine that is both safe and effective, but there's a lot of work between now and getting to that point.
And it could be a case like a flu vaccine that makes a big difference, but we have to keep revising it each year, or vaccines, I should say, revising them each year. And they give a certain percentage help, but they're not slam dunks. That is one possible outcome of all of this. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. We could have a beautiful vaccine like the measles vaccine or rubella that you get once or twice in your life and you're immune for the rest of your life. On the other hand, as you pointed out, with influenza vaccines, we're looking at having to give those year after year. And with coronavirus, we just don't have any experience with existing vaccines to make any good predictions based off of.
Right. People look back at H1N1, and as I remember, a vaccine came around fairly quickly, but that was a kind of flu. We have a lot of experience with flu vaccines. Is there something significantly different enough about this coronavirus that we're in a different ballpark there?
Well, I think the really important aspects really involve with how long immunity is going to last after either an infection with SARS-CoV-2 or after a vaccine. And this, again, is something we don't have a whole lot of knowledge about. It turns out that the virus causing COVID-19 has a couple cousins that are in common circulation across the country and here in Wisconsin. And unfortunately, when people come down with these two coronaviruses, they will develop antibody, but it's not protective for more than 1 or 2 years.
So if we don't have a vaccine, say, for a year or 18 months, some people talk about the idea of herd immunity, where enough people, a high enough percentage in the population has had the illness, has antibodies for X amount of time. Is there a point where that helps us slow the spread of the disease just by that herd immunity?
Absolutely. The number of people in a population that are not immune really serve as the fuel for the epidemic. And as more and more people become infected and recover and have some immunity, it will tend to slow things down. So we have a couple situations where we know, or at least have an idea of how much immunity is out there. I just recently saw a study out of New York where New York City, where 14% of people have signs of antibody to this virus. Another study in, I believe, Santa Clara, California, it's about 4 to 5%. Unfortunately, with this virus, you need to be somewhere up in the mid-50s to 70% of the population being immune before it goes away.
And the obvious downside there is a percentage of those people a long way to getting immunity. A lot of people are going to die first before we get to that situation.
Yeah, unfortunately, with this particular virus, as you just heard in your news clip, 257 Wisconsinites have already died of this. And that's compared to about 140 people this entire last year from influenza in the state. So even in this short period of time, we've really seen an incredible toll.
We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at possible futures for the novel coronavirus in the United States and here in Wisconsin. I want to give a listen to Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking yesterday on the White House Coronavirus Task Force conference. He talked about the chances of a second wave of the virus later this year, fall or winter. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say.
We will have coronavirus in the fall. I am convinced of that because of the degree of transmissibility that it has, the global nature. What happens with that will depend on how we're able to contain it when it occurs. And what we're saying is that in the fall, we will be much, much better prepared to do the kind of containment compared to what happened to us this winter.
Can you talk about the possibility, the likelihood, almost certainty, according to Dr. Fauci there, of even if this thing fizzles out some now, a likely resurgence in the fall?
Well, I think he is totally correct here that this is what a number of us are planning for at this point in time. Basically, everything we do right now helps to buy us time for the eventuality of this coming back in the fall. But at this point in time, there's a great deal of effort being done looking at, as I mentioned previously, the vaccines, but we don't anticipate those being available probably for another year yet. But the other things are antiviral drugs and things that are being pioneered. For example, the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine Public Health is one of the sites for testing the convalescent serum. So taking blood products from an individual who has been infected and using the protective chemicals or antibodies in that serum to protect another individual. But we need to buy that time to develop good, safe, and truly effective interventions. And they're not really truly effective until we know that they have been tested and have the appropriate scientific basis for making that type of claim.
One fear about that return in the fall and next winter is that, in one sense, we got lucky this time that this didn't take off, COVID-19 didn't take off until really the flu season had wound down. The idea that if we have a resurgence of novel coronavirus as the flu season is kicking into high gear, what would be the worries there for our healthcare system if that happened?
Well, every year we get overrun with cases of influenza. And if you add on top of that the amount of additional disease caused by COVID-19, it could really just overrun our capacity very quickly. Now, I've worked with influenza and studied influenza for the past 25 years, and this is something I'm very familiar with. But I have to admit that once Wisconsin schools were closed on the 18th of March, influenza disappeared within days. It was just dramatic, the effect that we saw across our state with school closure. Now, SARS-CoV-2 is a different virus. It's going to behave differently. We don't know what the role of school closure really is with SARS-CoV-2. But for influenza, it worked very, very good. We'll just have to see what happens between these two viruses if they're in circulation together.
Right now, we're waiting for the vaccine. That's going to be a while yet. As you mentioned, possible treatments going to be a while yet. It seems like the question now is, how do we go from this big, broad shutdown approach to that containment approach where mostly we get back to business, but we have the testing in place, the contact tracing in place, to where we can have a more fine-tuned mini shutdown where we need it? How do we get there from here?
One word, testing. And that testing has to be robust. It has to be all over. And we have to have a low threshold to test. Currently, our testing is really limited to individuals who are symptomatic or people who are of high consequence. Or to some extent now we've relaxed and we're starting to test people who are going into the hospital for elective surgery. Some places are testing women coming in labor. But we have to become much more likely to test virtually anybody for low cause to be able to identify those cases. And then, as he had mentioned, do the necessary contact tracing. Who has this person been exposed to? Put forth the effort for isolation of those cases that are positive. Making sure the people around them understand what needs to be done to stop transmission. Think about quarantining individuals who have been exposed but have not started having any symptoms or are negative with testing at this point in time. So there's a lot of public health measures that actually really do work, but they're predicated on having enough of that testing out there.
Dr. Tepti, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
And it's been a real pleasure. You take care now.
You too. That's Dr. Jonathan Tepti, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked with us about what it's going to take to get the COVID-19 outbreak more or less safely under control. Coming up, we'll talk about why meat processing plants throughout the Midwest and here in Wisconsin have become hotspots for COVID-19. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of couples are suddenly spending a lot more time together, and people may be seeing their partner's work personality for the first time. A psychologist joins us with some advice for couples stuck at home. First, meat processing plants have been tied to spikes in confirmed COVID-19 cases throughout the Midwest, including here in Wisconsin. In Brown County, officials are investigating cases of the disease in at least three facilities, including JBS Packerland, an American food group in Green Bay, and Salm Partners in Denmark. In Cudahy, a Smithfield plant was closed as a result of a COVID-19 outbreak. Our next guest joins us to talk about the risks workers have faced in these plants and what meatpacking facilities could do to prevent future outbreaks. Deborah Berkowitz is the Worker Health and Safety Director at the National Employment Law Project. She's a former OSHA Chief of Staff. Deborah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, one thing about these plants is they're open. They're part of the food system, so they're seen as essential. But beyond that, are there things you've observed in the meatpacking industry that might make them more prone to being hot spots for this illness?
You know, there's nothing intrinsic about the processing of meat that would make the spread of COVID-19 turn into a hot spot there. It's more about the fact that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention many, many weeks ago, maybe 6 or 7 weeks ago, set out specific guidelines like they did for us in the public about social distancing and wearing masks. They set the same kinds of guidelines for businesses of how to prevent the transmission of COVID-19 in the workplace. Because, you know, in this pandemic, in order to protect the spread of the disease in the public, you also have to protect the spread of the disease and reduce it in the workplace. And, you know, what we've seen is that the companies, big companies, Smithfield, JBS, and Tyson, that 6 weeks ago, they did not implement all the recommendations from CDC about social distancing, about masks, about ability to wash hands repeatedly with soap and water, hand sanitizers. You know, in these plants, as you probably know by now from all the news reports, thousands of workers are in these plants at one time. They work shoulder to shoulder with knives and scissors and saws. You know, it's like a big disassembly line. You know, they're on both sides of a metal table with a conveyor belt and down the middle. They all come in at the same time. They all go to break at the same time. They all crowd into lunchrooms at the same time. They all crowd into locker rooms because they have to wear metal mesh gloves. Some of them wear metal mesh aprons to protect themselves, you know, from cuts. And I think what you, the problem here is that these precautions were not implemented. And that's why you're receiving the COVID-19 outbreaks.
And you mentioned these are CDC recommendations. I know since these hotspots have been breaking out, people have been saying, well, why didn't, say, an organization like OSHA or state-level organizations say, hey, not recommendations, these are requirements as you stay open to do this. Why didn't we see something stronger than recommendations at some point in this process?
I think that's a really good point. You know, I was at OSHA for 6 years, helping be a senior official running the agency. And, you know, we saw that a lot of employers just comply with safety standards and they comply with the best guidance to protect workers because they know safety pays. You know, you implement safe conditions now and you prevent having workers get injured and die or you have to close down. But there are also a lot of employers and industries that don't implement something that's just voluntary. This guidance is advisory. Employers can choose to follow it or not. And really the failure here, in addition, I think, to the companies, is that the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, which was created 50 years ago to ensure that employers provide safe conditions for everybody working, that they decided not to make any of the CDC guidance mandatory. They just assumed that employers would voluntarily comply with it, and that was a very costly mistake.
We're talking to Deborah Berkowitz, Worker Health and Safety Director at the National Employment Law Project, formerly with OSHA. We're talking about these coronavirus hotspots breaking out in meat processing facilities around the Midwest, many of them closing temporarily. I want to give a listen now. Some advocacy groups have been calling for these plants to change procedures. Here in Wisconsin, the group Voces de la Frontera held a news conference with plant workers who got sick. Here's a listen to Raquel Sanchez Alvarado, who works for American Food Group in Green Bay, talking about conditions in the plant before people got sick.
They did just the distancing on the break room. But work-wise, it was the same. We work really close to each other. It's a packing company, so basically it was the line, and you know the line, you have two workers on each line, and then one was packing and lifting out boxes and stuff like that. So therefore, there were none.
Is this something you've been hearing, that on the actual line itself, you use the phrase shoulder to shoulder? I've seen some federal government pictures of how these things work, literally shoulder to shoulder. Is that a common story you're hearing from workers, that that hasn't changed?
Right. That did not change. And we heard reports for weeks and weeks and weeks from packing house workers around the country. And they raised the issue. You know, workers raised the issue. The unions raised the issue. But I think, you know, the meatpacking industry, I know they'll tell you otherwise in an interview, but the facts speak for themselves. And that is, they've never really prioritized worker safety. Their injury and illness rate is twice as high the national average as other industries. Their illness rate is almost 15 times as high. And I just think that, you know, production is king. Profits are king in this industry. It's very different than 30 or 40 years ago when I started doing work on health and safety with packing house workers. You know, now it's some huge conglomerates own the majority of the industry, like JBS. And, you know, they have really deep pockets. They have a lot of lawyers, a lot of PR people. And, I mean, conditions are so rough in these plants and so harsh. And the workers who work there are so brave. But they, you know, they have a very high turnover because workers get hurt just in traditional injuries. And, you know, they you know, partner with refugee agencies to staff their plants. You know, refugees are the most amazing workers, and they, you know, had such harsh conditions before they came to the United States that the companies are just hoping that they will just put up with some of these conditions. And, you know, unfortunately, because the companies didn't implement really basic safety precautions, it's at this COVID-19 plant, and all the workers work shoulder to shoulder. You see workers getting incredibly sick, and now some are dying.
And now we have some plants closed. Companies in a couple cases have closed them voluntarily, and at least one case in South Dakota voluntarily, with heavy pressure from the governor and a local mayor there, I know. With that kind of financial hit of having to close plants, do you see processors starting to take this more seriously now to have better safety guidelines in place so they can stay open?
I sure hope they do. I mean, it was very short-sighted of them not to implement the basic safety precautions. And, you know, they may have probably had to slow down production 6 weeks ago in order to do it, but at least the plants would still be open now. I mean, these plants really cannot open up again until there are some precautions in place for workers. You know, in addition to your previous guest talking about testing, there also has to be a sick leave policy put into place with people that are already sick or are vulnerable to COVID-19 to get a more severe illness, that they get to stay home and are protected from retaliation. But also, workers have to be 6 feet apart on that line. And they need to have masks, just like you and I are supposed to wear masks. Like here in Washington, D.C., you can't go out of your house without wearing a mask and into every store. And in Maryland, every grocery store worker has a mask. All the workers need to have a mask, a surgical type mask, you know, not an N95, because we need to keep those for our hospital workers right now. But, you know, with a moldable nose piece to fit over the nose so that it, you know, it's more of a snug fit, because one thing we know is there is significant risk of transmission of this disease from individuals who are pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, no fever, no signs. And so you want everybody in a mask just in case you have COVID-19 and you don't have any idea. And so, you know, what we've heard is companies telling people to wear something that is so less protective than even a regular cotton mask. And I think there has to be stepped up sanitation and the ability to wash hands with soap and water.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Deborah Berkowitz, Worker and Health and Safety Director at the National Employment Law Project, joining us today to talk about why we've seen a rash of COVID-19 outbreaks at meat processing plants here in Wisconsin and all around the Midwest. Happy 456th birthday today to William Shakespeare, probably. Historians apparently aren't 100% sure on this, but the best evidence points to April 23rd, 1564. Weirdly, his birthday was also his day of death. This seems rock solid that Shakespeare died on April 23rd, 1616. If you want to mark the occasion, you can't really go out and see a Shakespeare play or any play right now, but the theater community has you covered. The Globe Theatre in London, which is the modern version of Shakespeare's home playing field, is offering online performances and virtual tours. On their YouTube channel right now, you can see their 2009 performance of Romeo and Juliet, and they have a schedule of premiere dates rolling out with past performances of Macbeth, A Midsummer Night's Dream, and more. Closer to home, American Players Theatre in Spring Green has some online offerings. The newest one I saw is titled A Shakespeare Mashup, with APT actors performing some of the biggest lines in the theater of their living rooms and kitchens. Plus, now this one isn't Shakespeare, but they just kicked off a series at APT of poetry readings on YouTube. And they have made a dramatic public service video demonstrating good hand-washing technique. It looks very effective, even if it might not wash out each and every spot that might have a Shakespeare character worried. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.